Hey, everybody. This is such a nice group. I think what we'll go on and do is start with this prayer, and then we'll kind of work through it, and I've got some notes, and then we'll end in the prayer, and then we'll just, you know, discuss or ask questions or whatever. My name's Melina Smith, to start first, and I have a master's in counseling, and I've been working with families for a long time. And I was a behavior therapist for a while, and working with families specifically. So I've really looked at the family dynamic for a while, and now I have my own kids, so that adds another layer of insight and experience, which I've found very interesting. And also, I think viewing family through the lens of the gospel and what the Christian perspective has to say, I think is different than those who don't know that they're completely forgiven. So anyway, so we'll go on and get started. I will start with this prayer. It's an old prayer from St. Augustine. I found an old prayer book in our house, and I use it every day. We live in an old space, and actually we found a bunch of old prayer books from the 1776, and so we use them. Anyway, so let's get started. O Heavenly Father, I commend the souls of my children to Thee. Be Thou their God and Father, and mercifully supply whatever is wanting in me through frailty or negligence. Strengthen them to overcome the corruptions of the world, to resist all solicitations to evil, whether from within or without, and deliver them from grace into their hearts, and confirm and multiply in them the gifts of Thy Holy Spirit, that they may daily grow in grace and in knowledge of our Lord Jesus Christ, and so faithfully serving Thee here, may come to rejoice in Thy presence hereafter. Through the same Christ our Lord. Amen. I have three ideas that I think relate to the power struggles we encounter in family in general. So this isn't really just for people with small children. This is for people who have a family, whatever that is. And I think that there are three things that play into that and our denial. But we do have a hope. So the first thing I think we do is we imagine our children, or we've experienced our parents treating us as extensions of themselves. It's easy to do. They look like you. They have traits similar to you. They just do things that are genetically akin to you. So it's easy to find yourself trapped in the idea that they are mini versions of yourself. And I think in that, and the denial of that truth of our lives, we find ourselves getting into trouble with our children and how we relate to them. I think the second thing that we do is we often encounter power struggle with our little ones because they often, or just our children in general, I'm sure Sophia will do this when she's an adult. Their behaviors will shame or embarrass us because, whether we know it or we aren't aware of it, we are judged by them. We feel judged by them. People judge other people by their families and their kids and how they behave often. And I think our hope and desire to be families that love and forgive and engage one another, is one that realizes it's been forgiven. And I think in that we have hope. So, I have some notes. I think last night's talk was so good about the denial. It's interesting, you know, I'm not a charismatic, but I think the Holy Spirit is at work very much so in these conferences, and I feel that our thoughts are so similarly linked, all of the speakers, and it's amazing. And I think that what was said yesterday about denial about parenthood and families was So couldn't have been truer. So I think let's take a look at the power struggle. So where does this power struggle begin? I think it begins with us as individuals, whether we have kids or we don't. We're all in constant battle with God to be the center of the universe. And I think it plays out really well in family. What happens is, and people who are married identify with this, I think, because you've got two people trying to become one thing, which, you know, is not easy. And with family, you've got more individuals becoming one thing. Whether aware of it or not, each family has its own vision. It's moving towards something. And families struggle because I think they are not aware that it's ruled by one personality. It could be a needy child. It could be an aggressive father. It could be a whatever. Whoever's got the stronger personality often rules the day. And I think what happens is that we're just not aware of that. And when we become aware that we are moving towards something, that we do have an identity, then we can deal with who we are, and we can deal with the reality that we're all trying to be in control. Whether or not the child who engages or hides out, that's its own form of control. That's its own resistance. That's its own rebellion to what the culture of the family is trying to be or trying to say. And I think our hope and what the Christian message has for us in that is our hope is that what we can say, we're sorry. Our hope is that we can come together as families and say, who are we? Who is Sophia? Like, who is Henry? Are we moving in towards something? Is our family dynamic, is it respectful towards who Henry is? Is it respectful towards who Sophia is? And considering those things and being able to be in a place where you can talk about it and being in a place where you can openly and honestly say you're sorry. And I think that that's where we begin to have hope. And I think that what God has given us is family also to strengthen us in the places where we're weak and to encourage one another and care for one another. And I think one thing that families do provide is strength and weaknesses in parents. So, and if we're able to look at one another for what our partner's strengths and weaknesses are, then we can function more clearly and better and healthily as a family. So, for instance, I might be a better nurturer, but my husband may be a clearer communicator. And maybe Sophia needs better communication in this kind of a way. So knowing who each other are and what are each other's strengths and weaknesses will also enhance the family. I think for many of us, we live in a denial of what we imagine family to be, or we live in the denial that we want a perfect kind of a family. I think taking a look at mom blogs, or there's this mother's blog called Design Mom. I think the Mormons are really good at portraying family. And if you think that you don't have an idea of what a perfect family ought to be, just go to Design Mom blog. And you will feel something. You will feel you are failing immediately. And you will realize that you do have some romanticized ideas about who you want to be or ought to be. I mean, the woman has 6 children. They live in France. All the children are trilingual. They look amazing. They have the most beautiful family photographs together with, like, vintage cars. And they all match. And their clothes is, like, all eco-friendly made. So if you don't think that you have that in you, just look at the site and you think, oh, my gosh, I do have some ideas of what I would hope we are. But I think that it's a good way to have a mirror and to see and to say to yourselves, you know, you hope to be something. Our is that in the right place? Is that who we are? Is that what God even wants for us to be? So, I have a couple ideas of what could be helpful for families. I think two things, the family vision. Everybody has one. If you don't think you have a family vision, you're wrong. I just like to say that, but because it's just true. Everybody has a family vision, and I think that it's usually not helpful if you don't acknowledge it and try and engage it. We really need to engage that we actually are moving towards something. We're a shifting organism as a family, and we often shut other members of the family out because they're not moving towards whatever the stronger personalities desire. And so if you can admit that there is something that you all are moving towards, then you can begin to think about the ways that you're treating one another and if it's, you know, what it ought to be. I think there's another thing that we can do as families is we can have rules of engagement. I think that parents need to establish rules of engagement when you're pregnant, you know. What's appropriate? When is it appropriate to discuss conflict? What are you going to do when you've got a stressful day at work and you come home? When is it appropriate to deal with conflict in terms of discipline? Is it appropriate to discuss the way your spouse is engaging with the child right in front of the child? Or it's a good check to have some ways to think about how to engage each other respectfully and in an appropriate time. Because conflict with children is difficult for them to handle, you know. And so it's important to establish what's respectful, how you can hear your spouse, what's good for the spouse, what's a good time to engage in those kinds of things, in those types of conflict. Because what we hope to become are guides for our children and not really wardens. And we want our children to have the sense, our families, to have the freedom to communicate with one another in a free and safe way. You know, with families, we always want to be safe. We always want to feel that anybody can speak to one another honestly and calmly, and that the family is together. And so, I think rules of engagement and establishing what is your family vision are two key things I think that will enable you to engage with each member, also allow you to apologize, to experience forgiveness, love, and growth together. So I think what we really want to establish as families, we want to experience joy. And I think we can experience joy with one another when we realize that the work is done in Christ and we've been forgiven. And I think that we experience joy when the behaviors of our children aren't accusing us in the kind of a way that will create chasms between one another. When our children's hurts towards us can be seen for what they are, then we can have compassion on them. When we know who they are and they're not, our opportunity to mold the perfect version of ourselves, when we can do that, I think that we are able to experience and grow together and know each other in a very respectful way. So in that knowledge, we can parent with grace, mercy, approaching each situation with compassion. When the behaviors are understood in that way, we can engage our families, our children, I think, through the back door, so then we become guides. Then we don't end up just being taskmasters, rulers, and we want to engage in family in a way that we can be honest and we can say we're sorry, and you know, and in the end, you hope to continue communication and love with one another, because I think in the end, God has given us to one another for our benefit, you know. So, and I thought, you know, now we could do is, if you have any questions about any power struggles that you're having with your children or situations that you're having with your kids, I don't know. I was a behavior therapist for a long time, and so I have some ideas about, like, my kid will never get, you know, I want my child to wear this in the morning, or we need to be here by this time, and I can't get them to, you know, get ready on time or be in the right place, or we're fighting in the parking lot about such and such an issue. So anyway, if you all have any of those kinds of things or thoughts, that would be great. Jeremy?
I don't have kids, but I get a question.
You have a mother?
Mm-hmm. And it seems like what you're saying is even just having awareness that dynamic is kind of the first step in maybe having a healthy approach toward how to deal with that.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I guess my question is, what is that healthy approach?
I often say, which is it's counterintuitive, when a child is power struggling with you, like you think of a kid screaming in a mall or kids screaming in a grocery store and you're trying to do 100 things or you have two babies with you. This trick works. I've done it with adults with dual diagnosis. I've done it with little babies. You start to whisper to them and you start to talk to them so softly. It makes them feel very calm and they can't hear you. And so it immediately, snaps them out of whatever they're in, because they're a little confused and they want to hear what you're saying. And so it shifts everything, actually. Because what often happens is we get louder and we get bigger and they're small and they get scareder and their hearts race. And so when we get quiet, they get quiet, and it will change most scenarios, I would say 90%. Mm-hmm. I think children are good with honesty, but they, you know, because they're not completely aware of family dynamics and what's actually happening, and they're little. So, you know, when parents are raising voices or seems to be aggression, they get scared and they probably think you're getting divorced. So I think, but you can be honest and you can say calmly, like, we disagree. And I think it's probably best, depending on the age of the child, to have your conversation elsewhere. You know, we don't agree right now, or I'm upset, I'm frustrated. They understand those very basic, feelings, you know. But you always want them to have a sense that there's stability. And I mean, some people just lose their tops. Like, they don't have control of that over themselves. And in those scenarios, I say that you say you're sorry to the whole family, you know. So, but it's more appropriate to have those conversations on the side. And as I think families grow and children get older and they're more capable of understanding emotions and, you know, your parents aren't going to split up, you can engage a little more honestly about it. But I would say in the situations where behaviors are out of control, parents have to come back and apologize.
I'd like to sort of ask a very big question. This thing about family vision,
mm-hmm.
You say every family has one, but how can you discern what it is? you articulate
it? Articulate what it is. Well, every family is moving towards something or ruled by, can be ruled by a personality. So for it, who's in charge or what's happening? Well, everybody's got one. And what happens is what we notice is that, families have an identity. So for instance, in your family, what are you guys most engaged in, or what do you, and it evolves. It completely evolves as time goes on because your interests and the needs become different in the family. And it just, that's just what happens. It could be one personality's career. Like we're all focused on dad's job right now and that kind of rules the day. Like this is where we're going to live. This is where the schools are. All of those things. Everybody's got something that's the main focus for the family at any given point, and it can be broader and it can be very specific. But it's good to have an awareness of it. It's like the families that identify themselves in sports, for instance, and you've got Molly who can't play or run or do anything. And so she's off on her own reading, and the whole family's engaged in like the Super Bowl or something. That sort of a thing, a cultural dynamic that happens in your family. Like, we're all really interested in music, and Tommy just doesn't like it at all, or something like that. That's sort of a broad example of what happens in family dynamics. Like, for us, I mean, we're a church family, you know, and the kids are like, we live in the church, you know? So that's sort of the dynamic. How is this working out for everybody? Like, as the children grow, like, you have to check in and see, like, are we listening to the needs of this child? And is this, you know, those kinds of a thing. That's sort of.
And I think oftentimes in family dynamics, the conflict arises when family members have, especially parents, have opposing views and opposing visions for their family. And this is why communication is a very important thing to do and to sit down and talk about this. It's amazing you develop visions for your company, your friendships, all of this stuff, and we oftentimes forget about the importance of a vision for a family and a common vision for a family, and to talk about that and to how does that include everybody. And when we oftentimes, a lot of conflict arises as the result of that not being communicated. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, you know, in the denial that it kind of exists, like you have a family culture. Any group of people that get together have forms of culture, right? And I think just being aware of it is helpful. So then other personalities and other strengths are not denied and they're not suppressed. You know, I think that a lot of conflict and distance between parents and children happen because they're not aware. And so they judge other members' strengths and other people's weaknesses, or what they view to be weakness in the family dynamic. Yeah, Hallie.
The title, I guess, of the talk is Disarming Parenthood, but as you're speaking, I think of how parenting has disarmed me.
Yeah.
And I feel like it has, you know, I think when you have not had children, and I'm speaking just from my own experience, so I think there are probably other things that do this, but I feel like it's a lot easier to just kind of shove things under the rug or leave it in the closet. And in parenting, I feel like there have been things in me that were deep down. My daughter found the one little line and just like made it blow up, you know? And things that have been revealed in me to myself and in the family dynamic. And I like what you're saying about whispering in the grocery store and these things that can help improve those things. But what about when, excuse my language, the shit hits the fan and mm-hmm. you hit the fan? And, you know, I mean, I've never thought I would ever hurt my child, but, you know, one time she really hurt me physically and I didn't even have a moment to think and I smacked her, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was appalled at myself and didn't know that I even had that in me. And so I wonder if you can speak to the ways that grace comes in when we have failed in those areas and when we as parents are not good parents.
Yeah. Well, I think that that goes back to knowing who we are and that we're forgiven. And I think that apologizing to children in those situations, coming back to it calmly, even if your child is one, it's difficult to communicate, I'm sorry, she has no idea what that means. But probably for your sake, you need to say it, So I think that developing that in your cult, the culture of the family, will keep you engaged. And that's the main thing, is that we want to be engaged and we want to be in communication. The conflict will happen, guaranteed. You're going to feel out of control, guaranteed. And what happens in those conflicts, the consequences of it, will be determined by whether or not the humility in the family exists. So if you can say you're sorry now, she's one or whatever, and that is a mainstay in your family, apologizing and communicating with one another, you guys are going to be engaged, and that's what you really want is to be, you want to be a family that's engaged. I mean, the conflict will definitely happen. It's natural, you're all, failing each other, so. Yeah.
Can you give us sort of a sample mission
Well, it could be as simple and general as we are a family that say we're sorry. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think that sort of does it.
How do you integrate your Christian faith in that? So, you can say we're a family that has unconditional love. You can say we're a family that forgives, or a family that are peace bringers. But that doesn't speak of Christ as Savior. So do you even recommend building a family vision that has explicitly Christian foundation?
I think apologizing can only come from knowing that you've been forgiven. Because, knowing the depths of who you are and then knowing that you've been forgiven, I think changes everything in family. I think it is not natural for us to feel apologetic or to apologize to something that's like this big and has had no life experience, And I think it's explicitly Christian to forgive and to have the humility to say you're sorry. And I think I just read the Grace Parenting book by Dr. Kimmel. Have you read that? He talks about, and I think it's a great book, he talks about building families that are strong and not safe. And Christians are focused on building families that are safe and families that are people that will raise children up that will be Christians. And we all hope that our children are Christians, of course. But I think that what he's saying is, and I think what we get as Christians, is that we want to build families that are, know that they're forgiven and that they're strong and they're not afraid of the world. And that's the hope, because we can't protect them, we can't control them. And you know that when they're born, so.
Mm-hmm. But, what is the most graceful way to do that where it's impactful?
Yeah.
Where you're not just saying over and over again the same thing, but.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. I think with communication, what we really want to imagine ourselves to be are guides for our children, not really wardens. And I think that we are constantly asking ourselves, what is the root of this? Why do I want them to do this? Is this necessary for their safety? I think a common example is children dressing themselves, and having lots of parents have power struggle in the choices that they make in clothing. That's not like a you know, that's not a do or die thing, but like Henry, I want him to stop when we go outside because he will run straight into the street. So there are ways that you want to, for instance, very, very pragmatic. You don't want to use the word no often, because when you actually use it, then they'll listen to you because they've never heard it really that long. They don't hear it as often. So you want to find ways to communicate, and you want to have words that are like safety words, and you want to like the word no. If you use it all the time, then they're not going to listen to you. You know, it becomes dull to the ears, and then they can get into trouble. So I think parenting is a constant check all the time of what your intentions are, and is this worth fighting about? You know, it's a constant battle of the wills. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When they're having a moment. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, it depends on the scenario. So if you're in your own home and a child is attacking you, your own offspring is attacking you, you separate yourself from that person. You go into the bathroom, shut the door. Let them work it out. Because you're only going to be engaged in that aggression, and it's only going to fuel. And we don't even have the real capacity to control ourselves in so many ways. So to separate yourself is the best case scenario. Like if they're on the playground and they're hitting some other child, then you separate them from the situation, you know, and you calmly remove them from the situation. In silence, I often do all of that. I don't engage it. Don't talk to them. And then what happens is they know when you're what the rules of engagement are. My mother will engage me when I act in a certain way. It's just what naturally occurs, because behaviors and people are self-taught communication through behavior. If you engage in these kinds of ways for 60 days, it changes the mind. I don't know why, it just does. So if you change the way you engage these little people for the next 60 days, it will change the way you behave towards them and the way they engage you. It just happens that way. I just read that Dr. Kimmel book, and I thought it was very good. Dr. Tim Kimmel, it's called Grace Parenting. I mean, honestly, I really think you should read child development books. I think you should read what's happening. I think what's also helpful, especially when you're having conflict, to say to yourself, this person has 2 years on this world. Changes the way you engage them. This person has 4 years on this in this world, you know. It will change the way you engage them. But to know what's actually happening with them physically, psychologically, in whichever stage of a development will allow you to have compassion, and it will teach you how to better engage them, what they're capable of. Little kids don't respond well to a lot of words because they don't have that many words, and they can't combat you in the words. So to be clear and to find the few words that you can use to get your point across is going to be much more effective than talking at them. You know, it's funny because parenting is so complex, and we often don't study ourselves and our own child development and what people go through as they get older. And so I would encourage you just to read some good child development books. That will be really helpful. So anything else? Yeah.
It's not fair.
Mm-hmm. It's not fair, I know. That's what Sophia says all the time, because she would love chocolate all the time. Or, I mean, they're becoming so sophisticated, you know. Like yesterday, Sophia said to me, I would prefer not to have this kind of a carbohydrate, because I say to her, like, we need carbohydrates and proteins, you know, and all these things, and so I prefer not to have this kind of carbohydrate, or, you know, just like the normal everyday, like, I've cooked spaghetti and they don't want it, or something like that. That's a very common kind of a thing. It's not fair, you know. Engage it. What is the end scenario? I always say too, this is always helpful in the it's not fair argument, is not to say no, but and to create a timeline in which they can get what they want. And it makes them, it decreases their anxiety, and they have something to look towards, and they're not so tunnel visioned on the thing that they want in the immediate moment. So for instance, like, Sophia is crazy with the chocolates, bubblegum, all of those kinds of a thing. So if she can't have it, then we said, then I'll say, yes, you can have it after lunch tomorrow. So when you go to school and you talk them through it, a 4-year-old can receive this kind of information, not a 2-year-old. You know, tomorrow we're going to do this. We put it on the calendar. Like the other day, this happens all the time. As soon as Jake walks in, she wants to engage him like a crazy monkey, right? And he's been to work all day. He's probably tired a little bit. So what we do often is we set a timer for 10 minutes, because he has a moment to collect his thoughts and put his bag down and all of these things. And she can focus on what she's going to hopefully achieve. And then there's less of a conflict, and Jay can engage her completely, and she gets what she wants, you know. I mean, we're all full of anxiety from the time we're born. And so as parents, what we want to do is help facilitate situations where they feel that they're achieving what they want and what they need. They need these things, but in a time frame that works for the family. So, you know, I'm cooking dinner, Jake's coming home, Henry's, you know, he's easy. So Sophia has all these needs. I can't meet them. Jake really can't meet them in what she feels is imminent. So you come up with some strategies to help decrease the anxiety, and she feels like she's getting what she wants.
It's empowering to her, mm-hmm. and empowering the kids to give them the time, you know? So if I came home and she jumps on me like a monkey, and my initial reaction is, not now.
Yeah.
Well, for her, what does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it means also, like, not now. Like, it means never, exactly. And then there's shame, and there's feelings of hurt, and stuff like that. But when we walk out life together, and we walk out the goals, you know, you say, you know, we turn the timer, and in 10 minutes, you know, we're going to play. And, you know, she turns the timer, or with the chocolate, and, you know, so you're going to eat your spaghetti, and then we're going to put on your PJs, and then you can. But when you say no, it immediately creates within her the desire to have it all the more, and the conflict escalates. But the yes, and you explain that, well, that's empowering. We waited 10 minutes. You know, this is great. Although she always messes with the time.
We have to put it really high up.
There was one time it was like a minute. Bing! It's like, let's go! but there's a plan there. You know, mm-hmm. and this goes with conflict, with marriages, and all of that. You know, is now a good time? No. Yeah, but it's important to engage and communicate as a couple. It's important to engage and communicate as a family and say, now it's not a good time, but here's when it is.
Mm-hmm.
And this brings value, and it says, you are important.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's what we want to say to our daughter, and that's what we say to her, is that, you know, it's in 5 minutes.
Yeah, it's more often yes than the no's, you know. And I think also an important note to make, just in rearing and marriage too, is helpful to know, is that we more often than not, we have more negative in our minds than positive. And when you think about your own childhood, people often reflect on the negatives. They think of, because the daily is more often mundane, and they don't necessarily call on the positives as much as they do the negative situations. And so I think when we're raising children and engaging people, we want to engage them in a way that is affirming and validating, and we want to try to engage them in a more positive kind of a way. So. Disarm, like your parents, the grandparents. Yeah. I'll have to. We get back to you. Well, I think you need to get together as a couple and decide what the rules of engagement are and what you feel is shaming for you when you encounter. You have to have a game plan. If you have a game plan and a time scenario, okay, I know my in-laws are coming from like Thursday to Saturday. Like, make a plan of what will be helpful for you all to engage and have a positive experience together. But also, I think as a couple, you need to decide like what are no's for you. You know, like for instance, I guess like I don't like it if my mother-in-law, you know, takes her all day, you know, whatever the major no's are, you all have to decide together as a couple, and you have to be a team, and you all have to feel like you're together on it. So even if you can't control what your in-laws, you know, what their behavior is towards you guys, but the main thing is that you guys stay together in that, and then you're not divided, and you're not conflicted on that, you know, and that way you can, after the time together, you guys stick together, because more often than not, people aren't really talking. It's all this subtle underlying, and the parents come, he becomes the child or she becomes the daughter again, and there's division between you all, and then they leave, and it's kind of like weird, and it takes time to get back together and re-engage one another. But if you can, I mean, I just think everybody's got anxiety. And if you have a plan, you feel much better, and you feel like you can cope with whatever the stresses are. And even if it's a disastrous weekend with the in-laws or whatever, at least you guys are together on it. And what ends up happening is that you all defend each other and you protect your own unity and your own identity as a family. That's really what you want to establish with your in-laws and your own parents, you know. We are a family together. We're developing our own culture, and you want to respect them, you know. You want to engage them. We want to stay engaged with one another. And if it's a safe relationship, then you should have an honest conversation, you know. This isn't working for us, you know, we love you, but it's difficult when you're like, you do this. And I think we also need to pick our battles. It's like, Sophia went to visit my parents. I've never taken her to McDonald's, ever. She came back and she said, Mom, I love Happy Meals, what are those? You know, I'm not gonna get into I'm not gonna buy her McDonald's, right? But I'm not going to get into a power struggle or conflict with my mother over a trip to McDonald's, because it's just not the kind of thing that's worth fighting about, you know. If my daughter went away to visit my parents and they were saying, oh, that Jake and that's not appropriate. You know, those are things that you say, this can't be, you know. Those are things that you engage your family about, you know. That kind of a thing. So you just have to determine what those triggers are. What are the triggers of the conflict? What are the non-negotiables? And then you can go from there. But you want to stay together. The main thing is to stay together as a team. And in a young family, you're establishing yourselves as your own culture, your own adults, your own people. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and I bring it up because I'd like to hear what my mockingbird friends have to say about spanking. Because there are a lot of folks at our church who feel that spanking is very much a Christian thing to do. And, you know, it's dealing with issues of first and second use of the law, safety, and just teaching children right from wrong. Mm-hmm. And, but then there's, you know, the issue that was brought up before, you know, I'm a teacher, not the kid by hitting you, and it's just illogical. And so I have a child with all that background, so I know that.
Oh, good.
I know there's literature, tremendous amount of literature against aggression, but there's also some research that says spending's more effective at getting compliance than, say, other things like redirecting or trying to use logic to talk to people.
Yeah, sure.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Parents.
Well, my main thing is, and I guess it's our family vision. We want to be engaged. So I think weighing out whether how you want to engage, like, so disengaging from Sophia is actually more effective for her than if I engaged with her in an aggressive way, like spanking or whatever. So if I separate myself from her, that says something to her more than if I, you know, gave her four swats. Actually, the four swats would be easy for her. And so I think it depends on what your family vision is and how you guys want to engage. What are your rules of engagement? I think for us personally, we do not spank. I just don't think it would be effective with our children that we have. And I don't know that it's, you know, we want to be guides. And I think spanking often communicates something different. So that's just my perspective.
Can I just say, too, one time, we already talked about it. I spanked Sophia. And, you know, hindsight is 20/20, and I think it had more to do with me. And failing to realize in the moment that Sophia is not an extension of me, but her own person. And I was angry at the extension of me. And I found that that was, so that is one of our, so I think it would be impossible for me not to do it out of any sort of anger, and you know what I mean, and so that is so I have to, and I'm bigger, and I need to check myself, and so that is why we as a family have decided that we're not going to do it.
Sorry, just on that note, I think it's interesting that you said spanking has been shown in some studies to procure obedience, but what kind of obedience? And I think the thing is that it's an obedience out of fear and out of not wanting the person to get them caught. It's not, I will not do this because I respect my parents and I acknowledge why they don't want me to do this. So it may be obedience even for a year, maybe even five, but they're going to go to college and they're going to sleep around, you know, or like whatever it is. And I think that ultimately the bigger goal is to have a meaning, like you've been talking a lot about engagement, is to have a meaningful, respectful relationship where you're continuing to come together despite the differences. And so to me, spanking is saying, we're not going to talk about it. I'm going to assert my authority on you. And because I'm more powerful, you do what I say. And that's a God of judgment and of hatred and of quid pro quo. It's not, it's you deserve the spanking. It's not you deserve grace. Or let's work through why you're being tempted to do this over and over again. So to me, that's why spanking is not productive, in my opinion. But I also think it's interesting, I feel like you are using the word engagement a lot. And I've read in a couple different just make our children these perfect little children. And particularly in the faith community, I heard a friend say, you know, she's loving her daughter, she's trying to teach her daughter patience and grace and to be this wonderful person. And hopefully, as a result, God will give her this child who grows up into this wonderful, graceful person. And I said, but what happens when they don't? Did God fail you? Did God not give you what you deserve out of all your loyal parenting? And I think the thing is that I'm coming to is that we can't be in control, we're not. Mm-hmm. So if we're engaging, sort of some of the things cumulatively that I've read seem to suggest that we don't allow our children to try anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a four-year-old, maybe she can help you pick out a meal plan mm-hmm. for the next week.
Yeah.
And she doesn't get to decide what the meals are. She can't have happy meals for 7 days. But, you know, to be able to choose between three meals or whatnot, like, that's not so much harder. But it's showing, I think, a respect and an expectation of a child's ability that I think you're saying is more about coming together than it is about making them what you feel comfortable with.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Less, or
I'll just say that I don't have my own children, but my parents did stay, both my sister and me, and I got spanking quite regularly. I ended up every day pretty much. And I would say that with my parents, I never felt like they reacted to me using a spanking. They never used it out of anger. But it was used in our family, at least in a very clear way, as just, it was one of the punishments mm-hmm. that you could sort of earn with behavior that was not acceptable. And so what they would do, I don't know that it was particularly effective for us using spankings. I think maybe you could make an argument for using other forms of punishment for bad behavior. But what they did that was effective is that so I spent a lot of time with my mom, and I would act like her, and she would say, you know, that's not acceptable, you can go to your room, and when your father gets home in an hour or whatever, he's going to give you a spanking. And so she was the one giving me the spanking, so it wasn't out of anger from her, and it was clear and calm, and you had to think about what you'd done, which was the worst part, actually, you know, waiting for it, because the worst part, the spanking was never very difficult to live through. It was not painful or anything. It was just part, it was more the anticipation of knowing that they were disappointed and all that. So I don't think the spanking was necessarily that effective in and of itself, but for them, at least, it was incorporated into parenting in a healthier way. To me, I don't really appreciate the caricature of spanking that where it's like it's a child abuse. That's not the only option. Again, I'm not an advocate for it necessarily, but it's not the only way.
Yeah, Mary?
I love the way you talk about respecting and engaging, but I do see parents explaining a lot to children that are incapable of applying
too much
logic to situations that are illogical and have nothing to do with that.
Yeah.
And I find that's
it's exhausting. They call it the helicopter parenting.
What?
Helicopter parenting. There's.
I'm talking about, you know, little people. I can remember people coming to the seminary and saying they were letting their 3-year-old decide whether they should accept a call to the church or something. I mean, they were that kind of.
Yeah.
What's going on there?
Parents are terrified that it's this perpetual idea that we can get it right. And so, with each generation, I think we think that we can make up for whatever our parents did wrong. We judge, you know, as if we could fully understand what our parents were dealing with as 30-year-olds when you're, you know, 2 or whatever. And so, I think it's just a reaction to it's the new wave of parenting trying to protect children from feeling stifled, you know. They're calling it helicopter parenting. They're explaining everything so that they are completely engaged and, well, not just engaged, but as if they were sort of adults. But we are their guides. We are stewards of them. So we are their teachers. And so we have to be aware of what they're capable of. They're not little adults, you know. And so...
It feels like they're giving too much power to the child, actually, in a way that makes the child actually a steward.
Well, and it's not helpful when they will go to school. And there are different kinds of rules of engagement. So your teacher isn't going to explain to you every little thing. You know, they don't have to. Or your Sunday school teacher, or wherever you engage other adults. So... It's not that helpful to give them so many choices that aren't actually teaching them anything, you know. So, for instance, like, I mean, I guess, like with Sophia or whatever, like for meals or something, like, I don't need to give her like 100 choices, but I could say, like, do you want to pour the tomato sauce in, or you want to pour the cheese in, but I don't need to say, do you want to help me make dinner, or, you know, is that the choice that you really want right now? We need to put boundaries, because we are teaching them, and frame things within choices that are engaging and guiding them towards something, towards the...
Thank you.
You're done. Yeah. Okay. Thanks.